You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Teresa Kotsarilis, filling in for Philip Yun. So here in the U.S., we've been talking a lot about just how fragile our democracy is. And meanwhile, on the other side of the globe, the world's largest democracy is having a crisis of its own.
We're talking about India because in a year of global protests, they're in the midst of the biggest one anywhere.
The streets erupted in running battles, with farmers and their supporters pitted against riot police.
India's farmers have launched what might be the largest protest movement in modern history, and it's been going on for months. Last November, an estimated 250 million Indians went on strike in solidarity with them. Now, tens of thousands of farmers are camped just outside of New Delhi, the nation's capital. And the government's response has raised troubling questions about basic civil rights in India and what critics have called the country's slide towards authoritarianism. This all started last fall with some rushed and controversial legislation. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government introduced a series of agricultural reforms. More than half of India's 1.3 billion people rely on farming for a living, and Modi's government said the new laws would help farmers make more money. Farmers complained that eliminating certain government protections would actually make their livelihoods less secure. In a deregulated system, they just wouldn't be able to compete with big corporations and could even lose their land. We are fighting for our land, a farmer told the BBC earlier this month. We're fighting for our rights. People have died in this movement. Activists have been detained and allegedly tortured. And until recently, the rest of the world wasn't really paying attention. Maybe you first heard about the protests on CNN or read about them in the paper. Or, if you don't live in India, well, maybe you heard about them like this.
Pop singer Rihanna has started a social media storm after shining the spotlight on India's massive farmer protest.
Rihanna questioned why the issue hasn't been spoken about.
I mean, I'm sorry it took like a Rihanna tweet for America to notice this. I don't know what that says about America, but, you know, that's the world we live in.
Pranav Dixit is a BuzzFeed tech reporter based in New Delhi, and he's been following the protests for months now. When I interviewed him, he was trying and failing to take a vacation.
I'm sitting in a hotel room in the middle of nowhere, up in the hills.
He ended up doing a series of interviews over a patchy Wi-Fi connection near a busy street. So that's what you're hearing in the background. Rihanna retweeted a CNN article about India's farmer protests on February 2nd. And Pranav says it was a surprisingly big deal. India's Ministry of External Affairs actually issued a response. Then the tweet set off something of a chain reaction.
Greta Thunberg also tweeted. A bunch of really high-profile people around the world got involved in.
Pro-government protesters responded by burning posters of Rihanna and Greta Thunberg earlier this month. There are a couple reasons the Indian government got so upset with Rihanna and Greta Thunberg. And one of them is that they undermined part of the government's strategy here. Prime Minister Narendra Modi is a right-wing Hindu nationalist. His government has repeatedly jailed its opponents and persecuted religious minorities. The farmers' protests might be the biggest political challenge his government has faced. And, as expected, it's responded by cracking down on free speech. Modi's party and supporters are using social media to shape the narrative around them. And Twitter, in particular, is fighting back.
Modi is sort of widely known as the first social media prime minister. His rise to the highest office in the land was fueled pretty much by Twitter and Facebook, which was sort of taking off in the country at the time that he was coming to power.
Modi belongs to the Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, and it's known for its formidable social media campaigns. Modi's own account is carefully crafted by party officials and tech experts. And today, he has over 65 million Twitter followers. He's the second most widely followed political leader in the world. Barack Obama is the first, if you are wondering.
Modi and his supporters, I think, have used Twitter to sort of really do a good job of setting the agenda and setting the narrative. A very small number of Indians actually use Twitter actively. It's a very small user base. I think it's somewhere around 70 million people. But what happens on Twitter and what is said on Twitter and the narrative that trends on Twitter eventually becomes the national narrative. Because from Twitter, it sort of filters down to the television news debates. And from there, everybody starts to talk about it. So I think Twitter is sort of this place where the government really sets its talking points and disseminates them to the general public.
And when it comes to setting those talking points, Modi's party and supporters have a lot of latitude. In the U.S., platforms like Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter have been criticized repeatedly for violating their own content moderation standards, for spreading rampant misinformation, for instance, or hate speech. In India, Pranav says this problem's even worse.
There is a double standard in how American tech companies enforce their own policies in the United States versus the rest of the world. It's always struck me as slightly hypocritical because on one hand, a lot of these companies, when they talked about India, it was always like, oh, this is our fastest growing market. This is our most important market. The next billion users, blah, blah, blah. And the story around that is that, you know, they've pretty much taken over the US and Europe and the markets in sort of the Western world. But this is a huge market with a lot of potential. You have almost half the country that still isn't online and is rapidly coming online. And Silicon Valley sees this as a huge opportunity for growth. So they've always been super gushy about India. But at the same time, they have not really done anything to prevent the harms that their platforms cause in a country like India.
You could dedicate a whole podcast to India's misinformation problem. There are the conspiracy theories on YouTube and the baseless, violent rumors on WhatsApp, which fueled a wave of murders in 2018.
Rumors on WhatsApp said the victims were kidnapping kids or harvesting organs. Facebook.
A typical rumor would be something like, watch out for these strangers coming to your village. They are going to come and abduct your kids. And what happened was, tourists who were like backpacking through the country started getting lynched because people actually believed the WhatsApp rumors and thought that they were child abductors.
More than 24 people were killed in Indian villages. Then there are the targeted misinformation campaigns and the fake news deliberately spread by political players. Modi's political opponents do this too, but his party is the most organized. The BJP has been behind a network of fake Facebook pages and allegedly controls a digital army of trolls. The party's head of social media is notorious for spreading rumors and lies on Facebook. And when it comes to hate speech, in a particularly glaring series of posts, a prominent BJP politician called for Rohingya Muslim immigrants to be shot and threatened to raise mosques. Facebook employees flagged these posts as hate speech and feared they could actually incite violence. But a higher-up at the company overruled their decision. She said enforcing the rules against BJP politicians would be bad for business. Facebook and other platforms have done damage control around these incidents. Executives have gone to India and met with government officials. That Facebook higher-up who was soft on the BJP quit her job. But still, Pranav says,
largely, I think Silicon Valley has been very hands-off and not invested enough in just, you know, stopping harms in the real world that inevitably happen when millions and millions of people suddenly start using their platforms.
And you could see examples of that hands-off approach as the farmers' protests intensified.
On January 26th, which is Republic Day in India, thousands of farmers breached police barricades and entered New Delhi and stormed the Red Fort, which is this historic monument. people supporting the government were outraged that this happened. And there were thousands and thousands of calls on Twitter asking police to shoot the farmers. And the word shoot was actually trending on Twitter in India. It stayed up there for hours and hours, pretty much. We reached out to Twitter asking them, hey, are you guys going to do anything about this? I'm sure a lot of other journalists also reached out to them. And that's when they acted and took it down. And it was just one more instance in a long line of instances of just journalists doing the platform's moderation work for them.
By the time the dust settled on January 26th, dozens of protesters and police officers had gotten hurt, and one farmer was dead. The Delhi police said he was crushed when his tractor was overturned in the chaos, and a lot of news outlets reported that too. But The Caravan, a well-respected investigative news magazine in India, they reported the protester had been shot to death by the police. As the protests intensified, Modi's government started to crack down. The executive editor of The Caravan was charged with sedition over his reporting. So were several other senior journalists. A 22-year-old climate activist, Disha Ravi, is also facing charges of sedition and criminal conspiracy. Her alleged crime? Distributing a Google Doc with talking points and tips for peaceful protest, which was later tweeted out by Greta Thunberg. And they're arresting more activists.
The police say that all these people were on a Zoom call and the plan, the conspiracy for January 26th violence was laid out here.
And then, in the middle of all this, dozens of journalists and activists' Twitter accounts disappeared, including The Caravan's. Which brings us to the second way that Modi's government uses platforms like Twitter to shape their narrative. When they can't drown out their critics, they turn them off.
There are also laws in India that enable the federal government to crack down on certain voices. I wonder if you could explain that a little bit. Can you kind of walk us through Section 69A and why it's important?
Sure. So Section 69A is an article in India's IT Act. It's a controversial section that pretty much gives the federal government the power to ask platforms like Twitter or Facebook to take down what the government thinks is a threat to national security, is a threat to public order. And depending on how you interpret that, it can be anything, right?
And the first rule of Section 69A is that you don't talk about Section 69A. Companies that receive these takedown notices aren't allowed to reveal any details about them to the public. They can't say whose accounts they were told to block or why.
What we don't know is whether the government is using Section 69A in a legitimate way, or if it's just doing it to crack down on dissenting voices on the internet. And violating that order comes with huge legal consequences, which is a fine and up to 7 years in prison.
This time, the Indian government asked Twitter to block over 250 accounts.
Some of them were sort of high-profile, you know, press accounts, like The Caravan's account. There were critics of the Modi government in those accounts. There were accounts that were tweeting about what was happening at the protests and giving people updates about what was happening.
In the past, Twitter has complied with these kinds of orders. But this time, things panned out differently.
I would love it if you can explain what is happening between Twitter and the Indian government right now. What is going on?
Sure. So Twitter was sort of forced to comply with the order initially. But 6 hours later, a lot of those accounts came back up. And what we now know happened is Twitter had an emergency meeting with the IT ministry and said that they restored the accounts because they were newsworthy and they were exercising their freedom of speech.
Twitter eventually reblocked some accounts, but they refused to take down the accounts of news organizations, journalists, activists, or politicians. In a recent blog post, the company said these dissidents were exercising their constitutional right to criticize their government, and that the takedown order they'd received from Modi's government, quote, wasn't consistent with Indian law.
This is fascinating because what Twitter is essentially saying is India's government is not following the country's own laws around free speech. And that's why this whole thing has blown up. Here's a Silicon Valley tech company very publicly defying a large country's government. This made the government really mad because something like this hadn't happened before. And the next day, the government sent a notice to Twitter saying that unless it reblocked the accounts in India, it would send Twitter officials to jail for up to 7 years for violating Section 69A.
Twitter officials haven't landed in jail yet. And for now, the showdown between Twitter and India's government has turned into a Supreme Court case. But Twitter isn't just refusing to take down these accounts. It might be taking a stronger stance against BJP's misinformation, too. Last December, Twitter applied a warning label to a tweet from the BJP's head of social media after he posted a misleading video about the farmers' protests. It was the first time they'd done that to a prominent Indian politician.
Why is Twitter doing this now, do you think? It doesn't seem like the Indian government is asking them to do anything that they haven't asked Twitter to do before. So why is this the moment that the platform's pushing back?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. The truth is we don't know why Twitter is doing this right now. To those of us who've been covering the company from this part of the world, it's certainly a little bit surprising in a good way. I should say that they're actually standing up in this way. I think at some point, companies have to decide how much they want to balance actually following local laws in countries that they operate in, but also not allowing authoritarian governments to shut down free speech on their platforms. I think they have to do this balancing act. And Twitter, I think, clearly believes that this is the right time to sort of start doing that balancing act in the country.
You know, one thing that this really brought up for me when I was kind of immersing myself in this issue is I wonder how information on these platforms should actually be regulated. Because, you know, when you look at the situation in India right now, on one hand, when platforms like Twitter police themselves, they can be slow to act, they can enforce their rules unequally, people can incite violence. And then on the other hand, when like the government polices content for them, they can censor dissenting voices. It seems like neither of these techniques is the right solution. So how do you moderate content? I mean, I'm a little at a loss here and wonder what you think.
Yeah, I think that's a super relevant question. I think fundamentally, I think both sides share the blame a little bit. The governments on one hand and the platforms on the other hand. For the government's part, and this is for governments around the world, really, whether it's the US or whether it's India, they haven't really come up with a good way to regulate these platforms. They haven't been smart about creating regulation frameworks. But the platforms themselves have been just so opaque, and everything about them is such a black box. We don't know how the algorithms operate. We don't know how policy decisions are made. And it does seem to, you know, people from the outside that the way a lot of these platforms enforce their policy decisions is just sort of, they're almost like making it up as they go along. We saw them do it with Trump in the US elections, and we're seeing them do it now in India. But it really does not seem that there's any sort of larger framework governing moderation or free speech rules on these platforms. So I think both sides share the blame a little bit. Yeah, I don't know how you would regulate them, but I do think there needs to be smarter regulation by governments. And I do think it would help everybody if the platforms were at least a little bit more open and transparent about how they operate.
Twitter might be taking Modi's government to court, but when it comes to stifling dissent online, his administration has one trump card up its sleeve.
Very recently, we had an internet shutdown in the capital, which is when you know that things are really getting bad and out of hand.
Obviously, we can't talk about the Indian government and the internet without talking about the many internet shutdowns that have happened in India over the past few years. So how do these shutdowns work exactly? Like, when do they happen? How are internet shutdowns used by Modi's government at the moment?
Sure. So I think it's important to remember that internet shutdowns existed before the Modi government was in power. I think we've had nearly 400 internet shutdowns at this point. We are the country where the internet is shut down the most. You know, it's not a good list to be on, I guess. And there's no official policy or there's no reason for these shutdowns to happen. If authorities in a certain area feel that something is getting out of hand, whether it's a protest, whether it's a riot, whether it's people getting lynched, it's completely arbitrary. Any government official can order the internet to be shut down in that particular area. And in most cases, it's the mobile internet, which is how most people in this part of the world access the internet. Most people don't have like broadband and Wi-Fi at home. It's their cell phones. So when you sort of shut those down, you're really disenfranchising a lot of people. You're denying them access to information. You're denying them the right to communicate. You're denying them the right to organize. That's been happening more and more. The government, for its part, says that, you know, we shut down the internet to maintain public order, to prevent misinformation and rumors from flying around in like sensitive situations. But really what it does, it really stamps out dissent.
Internet shutoffs have gone up under Modi, and they've gotten more extreme. Just look at Kashmir, a Muslim-majority region on the India-Pakistan border that the two countries have historically fought over. In August 2019, Modi's government stripped Kashmir of its semi-autonomous status. It detained Kashmiri politicians, activists, and teachers, sent tens of thousands of troops there. Then it shut down the internet. India only started restoring 4G to the entire region this month, 18 months after this blackout started. It's the longest internet shutdown ever imposed by a democratic government.
When I went to Kashmir, it had been about 6 months since the internet was shut down in that part of the country. And it was surreal. A lot of us take the internet for granted at this point. And to not have that for 6 months was, I don't know how to explain it. Somebody there in Kashmir described it to me as being behind an iron curtain where they couldn't get their voices out to the world and the rest of the world couldn't see what was happening in the region. It destroyed businesses that depended on the internet. You know, at the same time as all of us were on Zoom, and because the pandemic happened, people in Kashmir were not getting reliable information about the coronavirus. They didn't know how many cases they had. They didn't know where to go to seek treatment. All they had was updates from the government through like posters on the wall and local radio. We're using the internet so much to just live. People in Kashmir just didn't have that. They were just shut off. I don't know how anybody who doesn't have the internet for 6 months just gets to exist as a part of this global society that we all live in.
The platforms we use online are easy to manipulate. They fuel misinformation, extremism, and violence, and big tech has repeatedly failed to fix those problems. But when you're standing up to people in power, the worst thing that can happen to you might be losing the internet altogether. You're listening to World Affairs. It's produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Teresa Katsarilis, filling in for Philip Yun. So after months of negotiations, mass protest, and political repression, Modi's administration and the farmers have reached an impasse. But they agree on one thing. India's agricultural sector is in desperate need of reform. Farmers face crushing debt and groundwater depletion. The protests raise difficult questions about India's political future and its strategic position in a changing world.
Good morning, Houston.
In 2019, tens of thousands of Indian Americans attended a joint event in Houston, Texas, featuring Modi and Donald Trump.
When I met him for the first time, he said to me, India has a true friend in White House.
The rally hit home just how much these two populist leaders had in common. and that India and the U.S. need each other. Today, both nations are confronting a resurgent China as they grapple with unrest at home. To make sense of all this, Ray Suarez sat down with Ravi Agrawal. He's the editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy and was CNN's South Asia bureau chief. They were joined by Milan Vaishnav. He's the director of the South Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he's also the host of Gran Tamasha, a podcast about Indian politics and culture. They start off with the farmer protests and just how tough this might get for Modi to resolve.
Gentlemen, welcome to World Affairs.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be on.
Ravi, what's going on right now outside Delhi? Are the farmers still there? Are they being threatened with removal, perhaps violent removal, by the government?
Well, yeah, so there are still thousands of farmers and affiliated groups who are still protesting around the outskirts of New Delhi. The government has found targeted ways to shut down the internet in areas that they're still sort of tented around. This is a major eyesore for this government, and one of now, as you put it quite nicely, one of the longest running protests in the world and one of the most prominent in some senses in terms of the size and scope and also the constituency that these farmers represent. So the place that these protests are now at is a moment of stasis, in that the government has said that it is interested in discussing further. It has proposed perhaps holding off on these three new laws that are at the heart of the controversy. It is said that maybe we can put a stay on them for 12 to 18 months, but that's really not enough for the farmers. I think they still remain steadfast in their opinion that the laws at their core don't serve their purposes well. And what this goes back to, of course, and we can discuss this more, is the way in which these laws were introduced, which is the larger part of the problem of why the farmers are opposing them.
Milan, the middlemen that dominate the way a lot of agricultural commodities are sold have been complained about forever. And it would seem like this law would take away their huge role in the system and thus solve one of the farmers' perennial complaints. What's the problem?
That's a great question. In fact, economists have talked about the benefits of deregulation for years, in fact, decades, of eradicating middlemen. Right now, if you are a farmer in India, you are basically selling your crops and your goods at government-regulated markets known as mandis, and these exist all over the country. Now, what the farmers are worried about is if you take these government markets away, you deregulate the space, you are going to trade one evil for another. Instead of the pesky middleman who might be shaking you down, you're going to be at the mercy of the corporate oligarch, and that you are going to have essentially large Indian corporates who are going to bring the price down of farm produce such that the farmers essentially will be in an even worse economic state than they are right now. I should mention that for particular crops, particularly those that are grown in the states neighboring New Delhi, there is a minimum support price or a floor below which the price of those crops will not go. There is nothing in this legislation about the minimum support price, but the protesters are worried that once you open up the space, it's just a precursor to eliminating any kind of price support that farmers might derive benefit from.
This removal of the middlemen, arguably perhaps raising the ceiling, but then taking away the floor, are agricultural commodities in India traded at prices very different from the world price for various crops? Would an Indian farmer entering a sort of worldwide marketplace for goods necessarily be made less secure, necessarily be made poorer?
Yeah, I mean, right now, farmers are somewhat insulated from global fluctuations. You know, one of the protections that they have right now is there are particular limits. So the government can place export bans, it can place import bans. You know, we shouldn't forget that even though India opened up to globalization and liberalized its economy in the early 1990s, the state still plays a very heavy-handed role in day-to-day life for most entrepreneurs, for most farmers, and for most businesses. And so, it could be a net positive once you remove all of intermediation that farmers are actually going to do quite well. I think the problem right now is that there is a real trust deficit between ordinary farmers and the government, precisely because of the issues Ravi mentioned, that this was really rammed through Parliament without consultation with farmers and consultations with states. And it's important to point out that agriculture under the Indian Constitution is in fact a state subject. The central government has tried to circumvent this by saying, well, we regulate interstate commerce, and so therefore it's under our jurisdiction to take these actions.
Ravi, I wonder if this isn't a reminder of the political potency of farmers and farming, sometimes in a way that's quite disproportionate to their impact on the economy. I read one estimate that farming, even though it soaks up such a tremendous share of Indian labor, only represents about 15% of the economy because of the way India's changed. Yet, they're numerous, politically potent, have to be heard in a way that's quite out of proportion to the impact that they have on the national GDP, for example.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why these protests have captured so much attention in India. I mean, this is an enormously important constituency for any political group, and certainly for the government that's in power right now. You can see from the way in which the farmers have mobilized that there is, you know, a sense of national support and unity among that particular group. I think also historically in India, if you look at the way in which farmers have been depicted in movies and in culture, there's a real sense of farmers.
Backbone of the country, right?
They are the backbone of the country, exactly, and they are respected as such. So when farmers protest, you take it seriously. But I think Milan was exactly right when he said that this is ultimately about trust, because economists for decades have pointed out that there are real flaws in India's agricultural system. It is inefficient. Most farmers are small landholders. They are not, you know, were market forces to be unleashed, they may be able to produce more. They may also be able to get much better prices for what they do. The system could be efficient in that there could be less wastage. There are all kinds of benefits that could potentially be unleashed with some deregulation and with better laws. But all of that said, I think the reason in part, well, several reasons why the farmers are protesting, but at the heart of it is trust. I think they probably realize that they could make more money in some circumstances, but ultimately what they fear is who's going to support them when, for example, there is a year where there is excessive supply and therefore prices fall. What are they going to do? What are they going to do if they can't access the lowest, the floor price that we've been talking about? What happens if a few big corporate giants get together and cheat them out of or collude in a certain way? There aren't enough protections that the government has mentioned in its lawmaking. So these are all the problems amid a larger climate of some distrust of the government led by Narendra Modi that I think is fueling some of the protests and is continuing to give it fuel, as you say, because the farmers are cherished in Indian culture in a way that gives them, you know, when they raise a cry, I think the media and people naturally are more likely to pick it up.
But that sentimental place in the national imagination almost makes it more puzzling that the Modi government was so ham-fisted about this. Narendra Modi is a guy who's celebrated in the rest of the world as someone who's a pretty good politician, successful state governor, then a thumping election victory to come to power in the first place, supposedly a strong link to the common people, the rank and file of India. What happened? Why did he come like a bull in a china shop on this one, Milan?
Well, Ray, when it comes down to it, the prime minister and his advisors are fans of the shock and awe approach. And we've seen this time and time again. You might recall in 2016, Narendra Modi, within a matter of hours, eliminated all high currency denomination rupee notes, which led to a period of chaos for months and a real hit to the economy. More recently, during the pandemic, with very little notice and very little instruction about how people would be taken care of. He instituted the world's most stringent lockdown of society, really anywhere in the world. And so I think he believes that he was elected to make the big, tough calls, and that, frankly, the voters have given him a very long leash to say, you know what, at the end of the day, we have trust and faith that he is going to operate in a way that is non-corrupt and that has the national interest at heart. And so despite all of this, his popularity across India remains very, very high. And I think that we shouldn't lose sight of that.
One thing that we do hear from time to time in this country is about regional, ethnic, sectional tensions. And going by who I've seen in the coverage, who I've seen in the protests, it would seem that members of the Sikh religious minority are disproportionately represented, that interests in one of India's breadbaskets, Punjab, are also very much at play here. Ravi, help us understand this.
Yeah, that's right. So Sikhs are, a minority religion in India. They are, Punjab would be the state where they are most populous in terms of their representation, in terms of total numbers. They are, often in a land where things tend to be framed as Hindu versus Muslim. I think Sikhs are often seen as, mediators of sorts. They are obviously not part of either side in that sense. And so coming back to when we're talking about how Indians can be sentimental about the farmer, I think Sikhs also play a special role in that process in terms of how they're seen and how their faith is revered in some senses in India. So that might be some part of this whole thing as well. But of course, as Milan was saying, Modi is a Hindu nationalist who is a majoritarian leader. And we mustn't lose sight of the fact that more than 80% of Indians are Hindu, and his policies are largely popular, even in terms of the missteps he's made, either in terms of the way in which these farm laws were unveiled or in terms of other past missteps. You can think of demonetization that Milan mentioned, the hastiness with which decisions were made on Kashmir, for example. But in each instance, Modi seems to bounce back. And part of that is because he seems to really understand his base. And more than anything else, I mean, India can be cross-sectioned and divided in many different ways in terms of class, in terms of caste, in terms of regional dynamics, state-by-state dynamics. Remember, every state has its own language, in some cases many languages. You can dice India in all these different ways, but perhaps the biggest and most enduring one is still religion. And I think Modi realizes this very well. And in playing to a larger sort of Hindu vote base and isolating that base or playing it against other ones, he has a base that is durable. And we see that through these protests and through his entire time in power.
So help me out here. Is picking a fight that's seen as a fight with Sikhs low risk politically? Picking a fight with Punjab, which is a more wealthy state, lower risk politically in those parts of the country that may resent that corner of the country?
Well, I think it's lower risk for two reasons. It's low risk because Punjab is the rare state that is run by the opposition Indian National Congress Party. And so therefore, it is not within the constituency of the ruling BJP of Narendra Modi. But secondly, as Ravi mentioned, the Sikhs are a very small community. And what the government has done and continues to do is to accuse separatist elements within the Sikh community of essentially galvanizing these protests to tarnish India's image at home and abroad. So in the 1980s and 1990s, there was a very violent and dangerous Sikh separatist movement known as the Khalistani movement. And it is true that the embers of that movement still exist in Punjab and neighboring Haryana, and they have links in the diaspora. However, what the government has done is to really hyperbolically play those up and tie everyone from, you know, global celebrities to people in on Congress in the United States, and protesters are saying they're part of a vast plot to destabilize India. And I think that is what has, unfortunately for them, exacerbated this already very tricky situation.
Where does this end? I mean, looking at Prime Minister Modi's MO in office, he looks unlikely to back down. And as you both suggest, there are some upsides in picking a fight with a minority in a state that's run by his political opponents. But this has to end somehow. This has to, it can't, you can't have hundreds of thousands of people blocking roads and fighting with the police every weekend to eternity. So given the instincts of the players involved, given the public sympathy, given the realities of the need to get a crop in the ground and sold, where does this end up, Ravi?
Well, I mean, that's the million-dollar question on this one. I think you're right in saying that Modi's instinct is to not back down. This does make the government look bad. I think the longer it drags on, the worse it is for both sides. I mean, for Modi, obviously, it's an eyesore, especially given its prominence in Delhi and the fact that this is a major topic of discussion in India, but also in global media. India increasingly has become very sensitive about how it is seen in the eyes of the world. And so in as much as a story like this one can land up on the front page of the New York Times or in a segment on CNN is something that Indians do care about and that the Indian government does care about. So that is something that they will worry about the longer this is sustained. I think for the farmers, on the other hand, the group has dwindled from the early days. I think as each day passes, it will get harder for them to stay out there, but they also seem resolute. So the only way forward really is for the two sides to sit down and talk. I think they'll have to figure out some face-saving measures in terms of maybe reforming the laws that have been proposed. But for now, it's pretty much at a stalemate.
Given what we know about the size of the governing coalition, about his personality, about the accusations of heightening worries about authoritarianism and a heightening worries about power being centered in the head of government. Given what you know about Narendra Modi overall, is he unlikely to risk anything, Milan, that looks like a surrender?
Modi is not known for backing down very easily. He had done so once before in 2015 when another controversial piece of legislation involving land and liberalizing the acquisition of land was essentially denied by Parliament. There was a real firestorm against it. And I think that has left a searing mark on him, and it is an experience he does not want to repeat. I think there are probably a couple of ways out of this, short of fully backing down. One is to hardwire into new legislation, essentially a guarantee that whatever may come, this minimum support price is going to endure for the foreseeable future. That's something, again, as I mentioned, it is a promise the government's made, but they could legislate that promise in a new and more clear-eyed way. The second thing to do, which actually is what a lot of people had urged him to do at the outset, was to encourage states essentially to adopt these laws on their own rather than pushing them down as a federal mandate. You could still end up in that plan B by saying, okay, if you're the state of Punjab, we'll allow you to design your own state law that can contravene our central law. But for the states that want progressive, bold reform, particularly the states that are run by my party, the BJP, we're going to continue full tilt, and eventually you'll realize the error of your ways. And so if I had to guess, it's going to be maybe one of these or a combination of both that will ultimately resolve this deadlock.
I want to circle back briefly to something you both alluded to, and that is the care that India has about its image on the world stage. To what extent does the growing visibility, influence, centrality of Indian minorities in other places in the world play into this? A very successful diaspora in many cases. Is there anxiety, worry that a mobilized, for instance, Indian American population in the United States looking badly on what's going on would actually mean something, make a difference.
You know, I think Narendra Modi has made outreach to the diaspora a core element of his foreign policy. He's essentially seen it as a way to kind of multiply and expand India's soft power diplomacy. And he's done this for one very good reason, which is that the diaspora really loves Narendra Modi. What we're learning, however, is that the diaspora in the United States, in Canada, United Kingdom, places where Indians are in large number, is that the diaspora is not a monolith. And in the United States in particular, those younger U.S.-born Indian Americans who are second generation seem to be much more disturbed by what's happening. And these are naturally the people who are more proficient with technology, with social media. They are politically engaged. They tend to veer left and ally with the Democratic Party. And so I think there is a real concern in the corridors of power in New Delhi that, in fact, the Indian American diaspora, which had been seen as a critical bridge builder between these two democracies, could actually end up being a very important pressure point through which the U.S. and others tend to intervene or comment or, quote unquote, meddle in India's domestic affairs.
Ravi?
Yeah, and so just to build on that, I mean, I think one thing that has become quite clear just from the policy responses we've seen from the Indian government is that they really, really do care how they are perceived in the West. And I think the best example of this is when Rihanna, the music star, tweeted about the farmers' protests in India, just trying to raise attention to it. She didn't make a larger point either way. She just said, hey, we should be talking about this. And that ended up becoming in India such a major, not only topic of discussion, moment of shame, but also the spur then for India's foreign ministry to issue a statement, not referring directly to Rihanna, but essentially saying something along the lines of, it is not worth the time of celebrities around the world to really talk about this. You know, no one cares what they have to say on this issue, even as India ended up mobilizing its own celebrities and cricket stars, who are the biggest celebrities in India, to all come out in unison and say something along the lines of, you know, we stand in support of India, one India, you know, giving the sense that any form of foreign interference, but also foreign commentary is unwelcome. And I found this something that was strange, not because it is how a certain section of India felt, but because of the defensiveness of the response and the sensitivity of the response, showing not only that India is unable to take criticism on the chin, but that India's government, I think it betrayed the fact that India's government is deeply worried about how it is perceived in places around the world and how on platforms, important platforms like Twitter and Facebook, that criticism of its policies there is something that hurts them much more than they care to admit.
Is that a sign, Ravi, of, in a sense, how new India is at this? For a country as big, as rich cumulatively, that's changed as much as it has in recent decades, it still has not played a big role in international affairs, certainly not proportional to its size. Is it still working its muscles, figuring out how to play this game in a way that's kind of surprising for a country this big?
Well, I would go for a variant of what you're saying, and it's less about India's ability and more to do with India's desire, in a sense. I think, you know, historically, India has seen itself as non-aligned. That is beginning to change a little bit. And I think Indian aspirations have changed, I think, in two ways, both in terms of this government in particular and how it views itself and its role in the world, but also how young Indians see themselves and their place in the world, which then informs government behavior. But I think younger Indians today, and many books have been written about this, but younger Indians today are just much more confident. I think they don't look to the West necessarily for every single thing the way an earlier generation of Indians may have done. I think younger Indians are more self-confident, and I think they also crave a more sort of muscular approach in terms of self-confidence. I mean, again, we were talking about cricket earlier, but you look at the way the Indian cricket team, which is such a barometer of Indian feeling and opinion, is just a much more confident team than those in years past. And I think the Indian government riffs on this a little bit in terms of how it likes to be seen, in terms of how it deals with the world, in terms of the sort of the comments you hear from Indian policymakers and right from the prime minister down, just this larger notion of India being a rising power. And with that power comes a sort of a no-nonsense approach towards not needing to kowtow to other countries, not needing to listen to criticism. And I think in a sense, this is what India has gotten wrong, because if only they would see strength as the ability to take criticism, if only they would see democracy at its core as a strength, not a weakness. And for that to be the takeaway would be better.
Milind, do great powers act so sensitive to slights?
Well, I think there's two things going on, Ray. I think the first is that, you know, India has long been perceived itself to be a big country, but not a particularly important one. And now it seeks to be big and important. And so I think that some of these growing pains that you've talked about and Ravi just alluded to are certainly part and parcel. But I think the second is the world has changed. And if you listen to what the foreign minister and what Prime Minister Modi say in their speeches, that America's unipolar moment is gone. It's a much more fragmented, multipolar universe. And in that universe, India can throw its weight around. And frankly, in the minds of many policymakers in New Delhi, the United States needs India more than the other way around. And so therefore, our American companies, the American military, American diplomats, American tourists want and need India to a certain extent. And so I think this kind of brashness is a reflection, a bit of getting used to their new skin, but secondly, the idea that they are living in a changed reality where India is going to exert much more influence than it has in the past.
How important is that which way India question? Maybe the fact that there's a lot of American companies invested there and a tremendous number of really smart young people coming to America to make their fortunes, and in many cases going back to invest their fortunes, is more important than, you know, looking on nervously as Modi accepts the accolades from an enormous crowd in Beijing during a visit with Xi Jinping. Because the big beneficiary of that question was Pakistan. Because Pakistan, a country that had been dysfunctional for most of the post-partition era, ended up being a beneficiary of American largesse as a Cold War counterweight to watching which way India was going to tilt. That seems so done and over, that question now. But we still have to, in some ways, deal with the cards we were dealt by the Cold War in an odd kind of way.
I think there's two overarching factors here that structure a lot of the thinking in Washington. The first is that the U.S. made a big bet 20 years ago that India would be the most effective counterbalance and counterforce to a rising China. That bet is notable because it's a bipartisan bet. It is one that Republicans and Democrats have both shared. And given the way in which public opinion has turned against China in light of COVID and Chinese aggression in many parts of the world, that India bet is seen in Washington as more vital than ever. But secondly, and related, is the fact that there is hardly a international or transnational threat, whether it's climate change or disease or terrorism, that where India is not a vital or important player and should have and would like to have a seat at the table. And so I do think that irrespective of whatever domestic drama is going on in India, whatever evidence we might have of democratic backsliding and of rising illiberalism, policymakers in Washington, including in the Biden administration, are really focused on the bigger prize. And so to that extent, I think Washington's ability to criticize, intervene, to sanction formally or informally is frankly very, very limited.
Well, Ravi, at Foreign Policy, you're trying to make the world a little bit more comprehensible to English-speaking audiences. An American who's just listened to this conversation may be thinking, yeah, I ought to know more about India. I ought to have a better idea what's up there. What should they watch in the coming weeks in this farm-based controversy and continuing encounter between the government and the farmers of the country?
Well, I think there may yet be more flashpoints. I don't think it's going to go away simply. And especially since, again, from an American perspective, since you've had celebrities tweet about it. And let's face it, that is one of the main reasons why this became a bigger news story in the United States than it already was. That may yet be another entry point into this story in the weeks ahead. I think, you know, at some point, the government is going to try to find a way out, to find a way of sitting down with the farmers, but finding a face-saving measure to still get their way. And we don't know what that is right now. We know that everything India has tried so far, that the government has tried so far, has entailed some form of suppression. I think for Western viewers, it's worth keeping in mind that, you know, India often resorts to internet shutdowns. India has more internet shutdowns than any other country on earth. India also has long been declining on every single press freedom ranking, on other rankings for measures of democracy. I think those are all things for American listeners of this show to keep in mind. But the other thing I would encourage people to look at is the China angle in all of this. And we mentioned this briefly, but for both India and the United States, China constantly looms large. I think the 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency sort of reframed in some sense how China is seen in the United States more as a blatant threat than as another superpower that you could collaborate with. And I think the early signs from the Biden administration are that, you know, they will continue a form of this adversarial approach towards dealing with China as a threat in some respects, but also as a country that maybe one could cooperate with on climate change. And this is where India is important. I think for the first time in a long time, since India had its tussle in the mountains with China last year, since that, the Indian establishment has really reoriented how it thinks of maybe not Pakistan first in terms of a threat, but China first. And I think that will also end up informing India's sense of its need for regional allies, the so-called Quad group of countries with which it has military exercises. That's the United States, Australia, and Japan, of course. But it also means that the United States will be more invested in terms of maintaining that India relationship as a counterweight to China. So those are all things, I think, to keep in mind as the story we began with, the farmers' protests, continues to simmer over the next few weeks and months.
That's Ravi Agrawal. He's editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
And Milan Vaishnav is director of the South Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and hosts Grand Tamasha, a podcast about Indian politics and culture. Great pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Ray.
You've been listening to World Affairs. Our program is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, First Republic Bank, and Chevron. Please be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for World Affairs. That's one word. And we want to hear from you. What did you think about this episode? What topics would you like us to cover for future episodes? Our email address is feedback@worldaffairs.org. This episode was produced by Jared Sport and me, Teresa Katsarilis. Ray Suarez co-hosted. Joanne Jennings is our executive producer, and our CEO is Philip Young. Temba Daniels provided research support. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. I'm Teresa Katsarilis. Thanks for listening.